This is Subversive, a podcast hosted by me, Alex Kashuta, to highlight hidden voices, uncommon perspectives, and our era's true intellectual elite, the anonymous poster. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so on Substack, Patreon, or PayPal. Thank you and enjoy. Today, I'm joined by John O'Sullivan. He is a political commentator and journalist. He was the senior policy writer and speechwriter in 10 Downing Street under Margaret Thatcher, and a former editor of National Review, currently editor-at-large. And since 2017, he has been president of the Danube Institute in Budapest. Welcome.
Alex, thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm very glad to have you on. You have the dubious honor of being someone that I've actually met in person, which is not always the case with a lot of my guests on the show, just because I live out in the sticks. I think you, having been someone who's been in the wider space of the right wing for a bit longer than I have, and having witnessed quite a few waves of changes in the right wing, maybe you could take us through what your perception is, because we're now at a point in the history of the right wing where something that calls itself the new right has popped up in the last few years. And I know this is not the first new right. There has been new rights a few times. I wonder what you make of this new movement, because you're in the space still. You're heading your own think tank. We met at NatCon a few times. NatCon is kind of a bit of an amalgam of the old right and the new right. And I wonder, how do you feel? Is this different in kind, or is it just a new iteration of something a bit older?
In a two-party system, you can join a party and actually be in several political positions in the course of the next 10 or 20 years. I joined as a young man, as I say, 14 actually, so 15 when they let me in. I had conventionally conservative Catholic views. I was on the right of the party, which meant I was in favor of what would now be called morally authoritarian views. I had the views of the disease of the young, which is moral self-righteousness. But then as I remained in the party over the years, I then moved to what was later called the right, namely the libertarians and Thatcherism. And then I have, in recent times, as you say, become a member, kind of supporter of the National Conservative Movement, which means I regret the absence, not only of the Nation, but of support for strong intermediate organizations, in the need for support for families and a strengthening of families, the desirability of strong traditional institutions, including churches, and those things. And consequently, I seem to have moved in a different conservative direction. But not really, because I, in all of these cases, and I think this is one of the traditional virtues of British conservatism, one that unfortunately now is very weak, which is to say, it actually tends to lean against the prevailing heresy. And if the prevailing heresy is socialism, it leans in a free market direction. If the prevailing heresy of society is a kind of what's the word I need? Antinomian liberalism, which rejects all boundaries, it tends to lean in favor of existing institutions. And yes, I have seen a lot of different rights appear, and they've always had strong elements I supported, but possibly they've always had some weaknesses. And I think this traditional conservative balance, which I scorned when I was young, the idea of leaning against the heresy of the age, I think that's quite a good definition of a sensible conservatism, and it's one I would probably embrace today. I have one more thing to say on this, perhaps. There is a very fine, non-dogmatic non-ideological definition of conservatism by the late Samuel Huntington, the distinguished American political scientist. He defined in a 1958 essay in the American Political Science Review, he defined conservatism as being that set of ideas which men turn to when the institutions of their society come under fundamental attack. And they turn to these ideas in an effort to stabilize the society. And those ideas are as he says, they recognize the importance of institutions in general and the desirability of existing ones if people are to live in a stable and decent society.
Yes, that puts conservatism, I think, in a bit of a kind of reactive by default mode, which I think some people might bristle against because it seems to be kind of just the standing athwart history view where, you know, we're just here to control the inevitable march through history. I think that's probably what I feel is maybe probably not a new twist to the third new right, which we're currently inhabiting, but there is this desire of creating an own positive vision, kind of something that has its own resources, that is not necessarily just reactive against the excesses of the left, that provides its own moral backbone, that has, you know, its own Ten Commandments, be they religious or otherwise. I think it's an interesting instinct, but it also does bring a lot of people together. Like, I think one of the interesting things about national conservatism is that there doesn't seem to be one very strict core ideology that all these people have in common. But it's also not just, we don't like the left. So we're kind of at an intermediary stage there where a more core ideology is being formed. Maybe it will be called national conservatism or not. But I think people are all sensing the same problem, is that you cannot constantly be simply reacting to the left, because it's not a morally coherent project. People will not gravitate to that. They might be repelled by the left for a second, and they will run to you to save them from the excess of the left. But the left keeps working in the background. They're still at it, even while the minor conservative backlash happens. And then when the wave comes back in, it'll go pretty much where the left wanted it to go, and maybe further. And then that's kind of how we've gotten to this point. So I don't know, what do you make about the fact that national conservatism, or kind of the new right, is still kind of finding its footing, and about this idea of providing our own positive vision?
Well, the first point I would make is that the service which the conservatism I described provides to people is that it saves them from horrendous errors. It is, first of all, anti-utopian. It doesn't believe in a perfect society. And it believes that attempts to create one, instead of creating heaven, create hell on earth. It's therefore anti-revolutionary. And revolutions, when I look at them, the record in history, the French and others, by and large, produce a worse rather than a better world. They certainly produce a worse world than a reformist approach would make. That reformist approach might be conservative or liberal in spirit, but in the end of the day, it doesn't do the damage, whatever good it provides, that revolutionary and utopian ideas do. I mean, when you can, and not only do they damage other people, but revolutionaries themselves become corrupt, and they in a much worse way than simply taking money and putting it in Swiss banks. They become corrupt in the sense that the crimes that they would once have roused them to moral indignation, mass murders, the best example, of course, those crimes become things they begin to excuse and justify, and then sometimes implement themselves. So conservatism has lots of flaws, maybe, but it doesn't have flaws of that magnitude. Now, about national conservatism, my impulse to supporting national conservatism began long before Yoram Hazany wrote his books, which I admire and like and appreciate. Yoram's distinctive and remarkable contribution to this movement. He is, so to speak, probably not a comparison he would like, he is, so to speak, the Marx of the movement. Why is that? If you read Yoram's books, you will discover, and including work he's done with Ophir Havery, his distinguished collaborator, you will see that they are deeply rooted in the history of the countries he's discussing. He is not English, but they are particularly rooted in the history of English society. He regards the great English, early English legal theorists, John Selden in particular, but also Blackstone and so on, as people who have given birth in that by their defense of an evolving tradition to a different justification and a different path of a different justification of English liberties and a different path to English liberties. He says, look, the English is a liberal society, not simply because people like John Locke in particular, but other theorists of that time, not only because they devised strong arguments for liberty in theory and deduced what should come from those things, but also because those liberties were existing in the society and were gradually magnified over a period of time by political events and by the response of the nation to them. I mean, I'm one of those conservatives who probably came to conservatism as a set of ideas, starting with Burke and his reaction to the French Revolution. And I think that's true of a lot of us in all countries. And it's a very good entry point too, incidentally. But there's an earlier justification for conservatism, a conservative attitude to our society, one that emphasizes the tradition of liberty that existed prior to the shock of the French Revolution. And Yoram has provided that. So that is one point. I could make others. I think maybe I should just make one. You heard me justify conservatism in a wider sense before, as uniting a lot of different factions. Well, that's true of national conservatism. In a way, what national conservatism discovered, why it came into being, was because in the period in particular after 1989, traditional mainstream conservative parties, including the Tory party, forgot that the nation and patriotism were themselves good things needing defense. And they became not obsessed, but they gave too much ground in all countries to the parties of the left and to the bureaucracies in no party, but which exist in politics. They gave too much ground to those bureaucracies which wanted to expand international forms of international governments, which increasingly intruded upon the national democracies of all our countries. And I found that in the 90s and the first years of this century, I found a lot of people casually dismissing the importance of nationalism and of democracy and of their own historic nation state. And I kept complaining about this. And it was that which led me to see that we had to try to re-inject into a kind of supine and reactive conservatism of the mainstream ideas which had given vigor and loyalty to previous conservatisms. So, yes, national conservatism is conservatism. I mean, I think that's the word national there is reminding us of something rather than injecting something new.
I think that's a good way to frame it. The nation there seems to be like almost like an anchor of last resort, unfortunately. Not necessarily in a bad way, but it does seem kind of the common denominator at of all these strands of thinking that build the movement. I think there's, unfortunately, the thing that moved us away from the nation and from other kind of levels of abstraction where tradition and kind of conservatism with a small c would be found historically, is unfortunately a little bit emergent from the technologies and from the market force. I mean, you mentioned kind of this overarching global bureaucracy that's constantly being pushed in a leftward direction, and it does seem to be something that is tied almost intrinsically in what James Burnham was describing, kind of this managerial superstructure that we live in. Because I mean, I come from Romania. We're a country that, you know, pretty much second world, and we're striving towards the first world. And it seems to me, and this is what we've accepted as well, that to become part of the first world, one must integrate themselves and their nation into the kind of global managerial superstructure. NGOs are a big part of this. Supranational organizations like the European Union are an even bigger part of this. And it seems like that is the trend. And to align our elites to the high status creeds that you have in the West as well, which all tend to be more in a leftward direction and are all kind of aligned with this system.
So, yeah.
Yes. Sure. I wonder how, because I mean, I'm just thinking about Romania as a country. Even though we're neighbors, I'm literally, you know, 10 minutes away from the Hungarian border. It seems like these are two worlds apart. Romania being a country that kind of has left itself go into the direction of kind of being integrated into the blob much more easily because of all sorts of historical things that we're not going to get into, but. Hungary seems to be like a bit of a port in the storm. It is your port in the storm, I think, because you live there and you do business there. I wonder how you see Hungary as kind of a unique country, because I do see it as well. I mean, being someone here in Eastern Europe, it's obviously has something else. I wonder what attracted you to it.
Well, this is not perhaps the answer you expect. I want to deal with several points you raised there, including James Burnham. But to begin with, I fell in love with the Hungarians in 56. I mentioned that before. I was 14 years old. I watched the television. I saw these heroic young people in belted Macintoshes throwing Molotov cocktails at Russian tanks. And I think I've been a bit more mature because I was quite a young 14-year-old. After the war, we grew up quite slowly, I mean, in England, because it was there was an atmosphere of protection, which I think was actually fine, but it meant probably I was a little young even for my age. But if I'd been a bit older, I might have sort of tried to go out there like a young leftist in the Spanish Civil War and help. I since made the acquaintance of a lot of people who are involved in that, and I did so long before I came to Hungary. But I did come to Hungary quite soon in 1971, where I was taking American students around Europe. And I saw three of the communist countries, and it was quite an exciting thing. In the Cold War, to go to a communist country, you did feel you were in a sort of spy movie almost. You wondered if you were if you were watched and so on. But I came to Hungary, and then I went to Prague. Then, in the depths of self hatred because of 68, and then I went to East Berlin. I didn't see much of East Germany apart from East Berlin, but that was a horrifying kind of experience. That was it seemed like a successful tyranny, which of course is not a pleasant thing. So I had all of those feelings. I was always an anti-communist. I was always took an interest in the other half of Europe. And I wrote about that quite a lot too as a young man. And I made the acquaintance of a lot of anti-communist circles in London. The Daily Telegraph, where I worked from 1970 to 1979, very happily, and with a very brilliant group of journalists, that was a kind of a center for a lot of the anti-communism of the post-war world in London. And of course, KGB agents visiting Russians would occasionally break free of their KGB minder and turn up at the Daily Telegraph asking for asylum, as a matter of fact. That kind of thing happened. So that's the background to my interest in Hungary. And of course, I became more involved in that, partly because Mrs. Thatcher was a heroic figure in that part of the world. And when I worked for her, and then I wrote about her. And then secondly, because after I was still, in a sense, informally working for her, I decided to ask for her help in starting an organization that would bring Central Europe and later a larger group of Eastern European countries into the institutions of Western and Euro-Atlantic solidarity, namely the EU and the NATO. Incidentally, I was myself a Eurosceptic, but I thought that getting them into these countries into Europe was an important step for them. Wouldn't necessarily suit the Britain, which I'm a Brexiteer. So I did that, and as a result, and it became the New Atlantic Initiative became a big deal for both more broadly. We did play an important part in achieving the entry of Central and Eastern Europe into the West. And secondly, to me personally, because I became involved in later contacts between governments. So I was that led to my writing the book about Mrs. Thatcher, Reagan, and the Pope, and it led further on to my becoming the executive editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. All of those things, in a sense, led naturally to my being offered a job working with the Hungarian Review, a fine magazine, and then founding the think tank, namely the Danube Institute. So that's the background. I didn't really come to Hungary in 2013. I didn't come to Hungary thinking I'm going to fight the Spanish Civil War, which in a way is what you might have thought. I came because I thought, well, this will probably be my last job. It's a very interesting job. I'm sympathetic. I love this country. I've been here a lot for the NAI, and I'd like to see what I can do. And my mission was, and it is still, to form a kind of a Reaganite, Thatcherite think tank in Hungary to broaden the general territory of what I'd call the civil society right. Thanks to George Soros, there's a large and various civil society left in Hungary, but there was much less of a one for the right. I mean, there was the political party, Fidesz, but you know, that's, as you say, in these days, NGOs collectively are maybe more important than political parties. And the right has never really been able to work out what it thinks of NGOs. I think they play many useful roles, but they're not exactly a democratic movement. They're not self-consciously anti-democratic, but they collectively they tend to be on the left, and collectively they tend to be pushing statist leftist solutions to problems, and consequently they tend to have the backing of bureaucracies, both in national governments and internationally. Not all of them, of course, but certainly the significant ones in them. And that has led, I think, to, that's another way in which the, as you rightly pointed out, the managerial revolution has migrated from corporations into global institutions and transnational institutions and into NGOs, which are, so to speak, transnational institutions very often operating in the international sector.
I think it's a strange position that the Western NGOs have in Eastern Europe that I've noticed myself. They're both seen as a bit of a an alien entity because kind of voluntary labor is not something that was very seen with I know, positive eyes here in Eastern Europe during communism, because a lot of it was forced, unfortunately. So people didn't really see this dimension of kind of civil society as being important or emergent from how they lived their lives. So it was always seen with suspicion. The Western ones, though, are seen quite positively because they're seen as entities that bring best practices into how to manage the state, how to manage anti-corruption efforts, and things that I have to say have actually seen a lot of progress. Though typically anti-corruption means that the usual corruption where you hand your doctor some bills or a coffee or whatever, cigarettes, that kind of starts to fade out. And obviously this is a positive change, but obviously other types of corruption bloom in other corners, maybe a little bit more unseen and unnoticed. So it's, I don't think necessarily it totals out, but there is something to that as well.
Can I make a point about radio? Sure. You're at Radio Liberty here. Obviously, when I went to RFERL, the Cold War had been won. In fact, it had been won 18 or 19 years before. But there were countries which we simply said, well, we don't broadcast there anymore. They're now part of the West, and they have democratic governments, and they can look after themselves. However, there were countries we thought which were transitional, and so our job there was first of all to provide those countries with a good working example of how a genuinely independent news organization will treat things, that it will be accurate, it will have safeguards to make sure it corrects its mistakes in management of opinion. It will ensure that all respectable shades of opinion are allowed to are represented in a panel, say, and that the history and culture of the country are given support and examples of their own culture being practiced and revived and improved. Improved's not quite the right term there, but allowed to flourish, really. And that's what we did. I mean, we were showing, as you say, we were, in a sense, doing best practice journalism so that other countries would gradually learn how to do it. And of course, we received, and I think we were very valuable, and a lot of people who grew up with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, when they were living in communist countries, like the former Polish foreign minister, Radek Sikorski, testified of how their political education had been seriously advanced by listening in. But my favorite story is that there was a Soviet agent who managed to get into the Russian service, and who subsequently redefected back to Russia. And he wrote a memoir. He was working there for Moscow Radio, and he wrote a memoir in which he freely confessed that the journalistic standards of RFERL were higher than those of Moscow Radio. Not the biggest compliment, but important considering where it came from.
Exactly. And the constraints on him to probably say otherwise.
Yes,
I think that's, you really can't understate the effect of Radio Free Europe. I wanted to mention that as well. I mean, my own family were, very avid listeners, and definitely did so in the highest of secrecy. It was not just frowned upon; it was illegal to listen. It was the kind of thing that you just did with your closest family members, and they would know that you would do it. You would be doing it, but not even the neighbors were allowed to find out, because it was something that would get you at least a visit from the police, if not actually into serious trouble. So. The idea of best practices and just potential, just the idea that there is something out there that's not constraining, limited, and just suffocating of things that you can see with your naked eye and that could be done in your day-to-day life, but are not done, or you're not even let alone to do yourself. Was an extremely important kind of anchor point for a lot of people. A lot of people who allowed themselves to look, which I think is a main difference between Eastern Europe. I mean, there's, even though these were essentially the types of regimes where the guns were pointing in from the border and you couldn't leave, and there was quite a lot of security around information and things like that, there's still, the fact that Western Europe was just over the border, there was still kind of a permeation from there. And I think that's something that you don't have in a place like North Korea. At least you didn't used to have. I feel like even there's a little bit more going on right now. But it was an extremely important institution for everyone. As was the TV show Dallas, which I still don't understand how they allowed us to watch, because it's just, I guess they thought it was, American excess and materialism that we would bristle against, but
an even more, there's a funnier example than that too. I agree with you about Dallas, but the late Tibor Zamueli, who was the nephew of a famous Tibor Zamueli, who was a commissar in the 1919 communist coup in Budapest, and was that Tibor Zamueli was shot, but his nephew was someone who was brought up in the Soviet Union and partly in England, because his parents became Russian spies, he defected to the West and was a remarkable force in English conservative life and journalism in the 60s. He died in 1974. And Tibor wrote a piece about the Forsyte saga, which was a huge hit in the 60s in British and other television, huge hit. And it was a hit everywhere, including as a classic, it was a hit in Soviet Russia. And he said, and the thing is, Russians are saying to each other as they watch the Forsyte saga, and there's never been a revolution in England, so that's still going on. And he thought that was part of the appeal of these series to the Soviet public. It was certainly, I think, the element of nostalgia. Nostalgia as a political force in late Soviet life cannot be underestimated. I think people looked back to a lot of things that were Russian rather than communist, and they felt that theirs was a great civilization, needed. It should stop being suffocated by communism. Now, of course, at the moment, we're not seeing the best of Russia, but I don't think we should forget that Russian culture and civilization, they have had immensely positive things as well as the current shameful abandonment of so many important principles and moral principles that should guide us even in conflict.
Yes, I think there's definitely a lot of tension in these parts in Eastern Europe about the Ukraine conflict. I mean, it's it's something that I don't think anyone expected to last this long and be so so convoluted. But yes, I mean, this is obviously a huge thing, which I'll put to the side because I don't think either of us is an expert on the Russia-Ukraine thing. But I want to ask you about Thatcherism and the legacy of Margaret Thatcher, which I think some in the new right would, you know, embrace wholeheartedly. But I think there are kind of clouds forming above the idea. I mean, above in general, this concept of fusionism, of the idea, okay, you can have socially conservative policies alongside kind of free market policies, and these will not, you know, they can exist cooperate harmoniously and will not infringe on each other, which I think is probably something that's more questioned now. And I wonder how you see this. Do you think that this is possible, or is there a little bit of cannibalization in there?
Well, first of all, I think Margaret Thatcher was a human being. She was a successful politician. She achieved enormous amounts. And she's not, she's open, her historical record is open to criticism, of course. So we don't want hagiography in her own autobiographical memoirs, not hagiography either. I mean, she confesses, for example, that her policy on German reunification met with complete failure. I think actually I would be slightly more favorable to it than that, but still, we can freely criticize Mrs. Thatcher, right? That said, it is absolutely crazy for either a political party called Conservative or a broader movement called Conservative to reject and denounce and demonize the record and policies of its most successful practitioners since the Second World War. Successful in terms of reviving the nation and providing strong and effective good government for the 11 and a half years she had in office, and successful too in actually creating circumstances in which she won 4 elections, and finally successful in that it had enormous historical impact. Now, most of the criticism of Mrs. Thatcher, and of Ronald Reagan too, incidentally, who was, of course, not only her great partner, but her equivalent in a more powerful country, somebody who came in, took over a country that was suffering from extreme demoralization, and revived its self-confidence, its economy, and its power in the world, and left America a stronger and richer country, and a country that carried on getting stronger and richer for several years after he left office. The argument that Mrs. Thatcher and Reagan are responsible for, let us say, the 2008 crash, which you often hear, is complete and utter nonsense. First of all, both of them, as they demonstrated in their early years of beating inflation, were prepared to take very, very strong measures in order to restore a sound currency as well as a strong economy. Let's say what I think is behind this. So it's nonsense to the thing the grounds on which they're attacked are nonsense, in my view. And one of the ways we can see they're nonsense is that the same things for which they are attacked took place in countries in which their views had never had the slightest support. Now, let's get on to the reality. Mrs. Thatcher took office in 1979, Reagan in 1980. Neither president nor prime minister can pick and choose the historical political challenges with which they are presented. She was presented with a country that was suffering from excess labor union power and the decay of legal and constitutional constraints upon it. She was suffering from a country that was with high rates of inflation and a staggering misallocation of resources, which was leading also to stagnation on the work floor. And she was suffering, and she had, the country was suffering from, well, it looked as though it could be on the losing side of the Cold War. She tackled all of these things successfully. She created, along with Reagan, a new status quo nationally and internationally. That status quo was successful for another 20 years or so, but it produced its own new problems, as happens in history. She wasn't around to solve those problems, and insofar as she was in the early days, the advice she gave, for example, changing Britain's membership in the ERM was advice which was good advice, and it's a pity that it wasn't followed. When events forced the British economy and the British government to follow her advice on the ERM, the country embarked on a boom, which lasted really for the next, well, it lasted from that point on another 15 or 16 years. That's an amazingly good record. Did she not solve the problems of other problems in British society? No, because they were, she tackled them in some ways. Sometimes her attempts didn't work. For example, she was aware that there ought to be better education in Britain to restore an accurate account of its history and to ensure higher standards of teaching in maths and all other subjects. She set up a set of institutions to do this. Those institutions were captured by the left, and she wasn't around to prevent that happening. That happens in history. A prime minister is not even responsible for all the events of his time in office. He's certainly not responsible for the mistakes made by subsequent governments. She was not responsible for devolution to Scotland, Scotland and Wales, which has produced enormous problems for Britain. She was not responsible for the excessive expansion of monetary policy nationally and internationally, which led to the crash. She was not responsible for the foolish housing policies, which meant that people took out mortgages they couldn't possibly afford, and that led, therefore, to all of the financial structures that depended on people paying their mortgages becoming unsound. So, yes, you can point to all kinds of things that happened that went wrong after she left office, but they weren't. But why should we blame her for those things? Why not blame the people who are in office at that time? And the answer is because if they're in office, they have powerful supporters. If you're dead, the only people who are going to support you are the people who genuinely believe in your cause and come to your assistance. There are never as many people who act from a desire for truth in history as there are who act from motives of advancement in politics. That's my case.
Yes. I think this is, the Machiavellian case, which I think is correct. I wondered, do you subscribe to the so-called great man, and in this case, great woman of history theory of how things proceed? Because that's kind of what it seems. I mean, obviously, a lot of people in the right like to theorize, they like to think about ideas, they like to think about ideologies and how those play out in reality. But it does seem to me that things advance, like in science, from a funeral to another. I wonder as well, I have here among my questions, because we've just been to NatCon, we've heard someone like Suella Braverman, pretty much the person in power, talk about immigration and things like that. And this seemed to me like having her compared to, obviously she's no Margaret Thatcher either in position or in the type of person she is, but it seems like the mechanism of power behind her is much more weakened than something that would have existed during Margaret Thatcher. So she you know, she was essentially speaking on the same level as, you know, the, you know, pointy-headed intellectuals that were there. And they were like, you know, we'd like to, it would be nice to have this and do that, and immigration should be this way. But she's in a, essentially, you know, the linchpin there that could potentially, maybe, if possible, actually do something about it. So I wonder what you see in terms of, in Britain, how close to power are the Tories, even if they are in power? Are the mechanisms still there? Is it possible for them to do something? Because they don't seem to be doing much.
First of all, do I believe in the great man, or presumably also great woman, theory of history? Well, the Marxists do, don't they? They call themselves Marxists. They don't call themselves historical inevitabilists or whatever. And I think it's impossible to deny that individuals have had major roles. I think if you're thinking about religion, for example, well, obviously, if you regard Christ as the Son of God, that you may not therefore be surprised by the spread of Christianity. But if you don't, well, the spread of Christianity is almost as remarkable, a sign of Christ's impact on history. I would say that to give the devil his due, Lenin had an enormous importance on history. And yet, if he had died 10 years before, 11 years before, if, let's say, he'd been an early... he'd been knocked down by a tram when he was living in Switzerland. Would we have had a Russian revolution? I don't think so. Maybe we would, but I doubt it. We would have had something, but something different to that. It would have been a different outcome of the events of 1917. So I do believe that individuals can have an enormous impact in history. Of course, Hitler is another terrible example. Now, what about the situation today? Well, the answer is that the Conservative Party was in a very, very powerful position in the, let's say, after when it won the elections in 51, 55, and 59. And that was because if you look at those elections, we came almost to that point, which is very rare in British politics, that much away from winning an absolute majority of the voters in an election. Generally speaking, the Conservatives do very well if they get something like 42-43% today. In those days, they got 49.5, that kind of result. Okay. What happened at that point? In my view, the decision of Harold Macmillan to try to reorient the party away from its commitment to an independent and global role for Britain after Suez towards the European Union, and the decision to actually try to enter the European Union in the early 60s. Which was not shared by the great majority of the Conservative Party, although he managed to, although as party leader, he was admired and generally successful. And I believe he created a fissure in the Conservative Party, which has never been fully healed, isn't fully healed today, although Brexit was a step perhaps to changing. Why was that such an important decision? It was because the Conservative Party, from Disraeli until that moment, had been an almost unique coalition of social classes. People talk of Labour as the party of the working class in all those years, until very recently. But in fact, it had a bare majority sometimes of the working class. But the Conservative Party polled a steady one-third of working people. And that one-third of working people provided the Conservatives with fully half of their vote total in election after election after election. The Conservatives were the party of free enterprise. They were the party of traditional institutions, morality, the Crown and Parliament. And they were the party of the nation. Both the nation in the sense of patriotic loyalty and the nation in the sense of a party that was regarded as capable of seeing clearly and acting intelligently on its view of the national interest. Now, all of those things, that was a cohesive party. I mean, here's an important point about the current rows in conservatism, Alex. If you're in a political party, and the Tory party demonstrates this absolutely clearly over the years, you'll have people with strong views of economic libertarianism, and people with strong views of national power, and people with strong views of traditional morality. Sometimes there are clashes and contradictions between those views. But in the same political party, if you're working together over time, and your enemies are people with whom you differ far more than you will ever differ with your colleagues in the coalition, the party will rub along fairly comfortably with a crisis involving the party every 50 years or so. And look at Disraeli. What he and Salisbury set the pattern, and the party goes on from about 1867 until 1906 without having, well, a little earlier, and then it runs into the grand clash between free trade and protectionism, which it had more or less covered over all those years. That's what the Tory party was like. It was a large, ramshackle coalition, all of whose members had differences of opinion, but who rubbed along together pretty well because they were confident that they were on the right side in a general sense, and their collaboration worked, and they would suffer worse things if they broke up and quarreled. And the problem is that Macmillan's decision to take Britain into the EU fractured that coalition. It took time for that to become clear. It wasn't until the 70s that the party's vote slumped significantly. Mrs. Thatcher restored that coalition, at least superficially. I would say more than superficially, but not totally either. She restored it because she was manifestly a patriot, manifestly and somebody who believed in free enterprise and the market, manifestly someone who in her own life, but in a general sense, believed in Anglican Christianity and she had good feelings towards Catholics like myself and Jews. So she was a friend of religion and conservative religions. And that meant that for a while, the party, all the factions of the party felt they've got someone at the top who represents them on her side. I think that Macmillan first, and then subsequently the conservative governments in the 90s, conservative party in the 90s, they never succeeded in restoring what Thatcher had achieved and what Macmillan had, in a sense, begun to erode. And I think that's the situation of conservatism today. And you see that most in its failure over immigration, because it has promised to control immigration and indeed to reduce it, but it hasn't done that. And as that has become absolutely clear, a lot of its supporters have become angry and disgusted with it. The most important vote in the next election for the Conservatives will be that vote which doesn't vote for them on principle because it's lost confidence in them and thinks they haven't told the truth. Suella Braverman, I think, is a fine person. By the way, Mrs. Thatcher wasn't Mrs. Thatcher until she'd been in power for about 4 or 5 years. So you never know whether you have a new Margaret Thatcher, because Margaret Thatcher took time to become that. And she had the real, we know she had the sinew and the guts to all those qualities. But you only know for certain when someone is in power what they really are. And we don't know about Mrs. Brougham. I like and admire her, but I have no, but of course I don't have the I don't have the evidence, but it's plain she is isolated in both the cabinet and I would say in the prevailing political culture, but perhaps not in the conservative rank and file, which unfortunately is now, because of her colleagues, still divided and still searching for a way forward. And that, I think, is where the party is. And it will probably lose. By the way, I'm not denouncing Sunak. Personally, I think the party leadership as a whole has made a mess of things since its 2019 victory. And Boris, who was leader and inspirer, has to take a great deal of the responsibility for that. But at the moment, we have a government which is detached from its supporters, weakened by that, and doesn't seem as a whole to me to know how to restore its credibility. I think that's going to have to wait until an election defeat. I'm sorry, that's a very long answer.
No worries. That's what podcasts are for.
You mentioned Burnham before. We never mm-hmm. talked about him. So I'm interested in your view of Burnham, because I think I read him very excitedly when I was a student, and I didn't realize he was still alive at the time, because I was young and I thought, oh, well, this book came out 30 years ago. He must be dead by now. But in fact, he was working at National Review, and I never did meet him because I joined National Review, 30 years later. But he was much admired as a colleague, as a brilliant mind and a man of great courtesy, but also a man of great sharpness and clarity of mind, which I think emerges from virtually everything he wrote. And I think conservatives should go back and read in particular his book, The Machiavellians, which has the Burnham theory clearest. And what that says is that democracy consists of a situation in which you have a battle for power between elites, which have to satisfy the voters in order to win and retain power. And that seems a chilly way of thinking about democracy. But I've learned as time has gone by, I've learned to think that's an honest account of how things work. And at the moment, if we apply his theory to that, we will see that in British politics and in American politics, an elite representing the highly educated and existing institutions, many of which are corrupt, is in power and is attempting to prevent the conservative, the mass of the non-elites, but which of course have their own elites, the non-elite voters, which resent the way in which society is going, and the people who are writing about this, like David Goodhart and people like that, with his distinction between a country which is, as he says, describes Britain, 25% of the Brits are anywheres, people who are globally and mobile, highly educated, with skills that can go anywhere. And then you have the somewheres, people who don't have tertiary education. They've got secondary education, perhaps, and some will have tertiary, but they are more rooted, they're more loyal to their surroundings, and they are more attentive to the locality and less to the metropolis. And he thinks that he thinks 50 to maybe 60% of the population, and with another 25%, which is kind of doesn't have a fixed identity in the terms he's describing. And I think there's a great deal in David's theory, which he outlined actually in a lecture to the Danube Institute before he finished the book. And we had a conference on what's the future for the European left. and everybody at the conference was a leftist, except for Gerald Frost and me, who put it together with David. And that was and that theory, I think, is the modern his theory is in many respects draws on a lot of sources, but in many respects, the application of Burnhamism to and the others have done the same in America. I think Burnham is a very creative political theorist, and in all his books, he says interesting things. One of those books is The Struggle for the World. It came out in 1946, and it was produced almost exactly the same diagnosis of what America and Britain should do in the Cold War, as Churchill did a year later in the Fulton speech. I don't think, I doubt that Churchill was influenced by the book. I'm pointing to what is, I think, a very interesting coincidence.
I would like to slowly get to the last question of our conversation, yeah, which is the question that everyone gets, the question of the show.
Yeah.
Do you have a subversive thinker that you think is underrated and that people would do well to read more of or be interested in?
Well, we've talked about James Burnham, haven't we? And therefore I can't include him. But he was subversive in his day because he took what was the powerful rising Marxist argument, and pointed out in his book, The Managerial Revolution, that that this was not going to lead to the workers, to the people running a state and society. It was going to lead to a new social class, which he called the managers, and which Milovan Gilas called the new class in Yugoslavia in the 50s, and which has been given several names at different points. Michael Lind called it the overclass. And I think that that the strength and subversibility of that theory is a very powerful one. But we've dealt with Burnham a bit already. So I would say, therefore, at the moment, a subversive thinker, I think he probably would feel thinker was too strong, but he is a subversive thinker, is Konstantin Kysin, the Russian-Ukrainian comedian who was sent to Britain in by his parents in when he's about 7 or 8, I think, and who's written a book about his feelings about the West in general. It's called An Immigrant's Love Letter to the West, but also in particular about Britain, because, and I might say partly, maybe I should be saying in this context, England, because many of the things he's writing about are specifically English things, as well as, of course, generally Western liberal democratic societies and Britain, which Britain is one. Well, the most subversive thing you can do now in England is to say, I love this country. It's a wonderful country. It's the best country in the world, et cetera, et cetera. And he does that. And I find it, first of all, persuasive. I'm a patriot of the country myself. And particularly it was, it's very, you know, anyone, if you say that in England, as a political friend of mine once said, you can only say those things on a public speech on the platform when people think you're being cynical. But if you say it at a dinner party, people think you're somewhat odd. But the fact is, these are the truths. They're worth saying. He's saying them, and he's saying them with wit and sharpness. It's a very readable book. So I would say he's unsettling a lot of people who would like to think they live in a shameful post-imperialist slave-owning society, and he's making them look foolish. And that's a very, very effective method of subversion.
Yes, I think that's a good recommendation. I know Konstantin, and I'm friendly with him as well, and I also agree with his framing of things. I think the most disappointing thing about about the UK was the lack of this feeling that I found in people there, especially in people who were more high status or saw themselves as part of the elite. It just felt very self-destructive and very disappointing, because like a lot of immigrants, people are attracted to the UK as its own a cradle of civilization, of an empire, not only of territory but of the mind as well. This is why people come there. It's not just the money, and to see it just be left not only fallow but spat upon in such a way is really disappointing. And I think very much deserves a treatment like Constantin gave it. So that's a very good recommendation. Thank you so much. And I want to thank you so much for coming on. Is there anything that you'd like to point people towards? Something. I know you have a lot of events at the Danube Institute, but any projects you're working on that might be interesting to people.
We have lots going on, too many things. I think we're going to have a conference in London on the 22nd of June. It's a conference on the future directions of conservatism. I think that will be, for us, it's important. I brought together a number of very clever people. This is just after the conference of the International Democratic Union, which brings together leaders of all the conservative parties. I'm hoping some of them will come along, partly to talk to us, but partly to listen to some of the people who will be addressing the question of how does conservatism renew itself? What are the ways in which it can, what are the new topics it should be considering, the new policies? How does it deal with the really thorny, difficult questions? How can a conservatism survive and prosper without losing its soul in a multicultural society? All of these questions, in a sense, come round to that question in a way. So I think that it'll be worthwhile.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I hope to see you at the next conference that I might make it to. We'll see. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you. I mean, your contributions are always powerful and really interesting. And you're one of a new group of writers and thinkers. I class you along with Mary Harrington and Louise. I can't remember her second name, I'm afraid.
Louise Perry.
And I'm told that by Rod Dreher, who's another such person, that I must read the works of Paul Kingsnorth. So
yes,
that's sort of on my agenda. And of course, Yoram Hazany too, who has, I think, really, if you were at the conference, I think you will agree. You were, but anyone who was there would have been surprised by the character of Yoram's address, because on this occasion, as on previous ones, his grasp of English political history and the history of English political theory is deep and fascinating, and he's saying really important things. Maybe not all of those I would agree with in the end, but I think he's making a lot of conservatives think back to the fundamentals of their ideas, and they go beyond, before Burke, not beyond Burke, but before Burke, and we need to rediscover that period of our history too, and history of our thought. Of course, we should never lose hold of Burke either. Thank you.
Yes, on that note, thank you so much for coming on.
But thank you very much indeed.
If you'd like to support my work and access more content, please consider subscribing through Substack, Patreon, or PayPal. See you next week.